Character actors. We may not always recognize them, but sometimes they're more important to a play, movie, or TV show than the star. The Wizard of Oz had Judy Garland, but where would that movie have been without Margaret Hamilton as the Wicked Witch of the West? Who was the real mover and shaker in Rocky, Sylvester Stallone, or Burgess Meredith as his coach? I'm Jim Meadows. On this encore edition of Focus, my colleague Jeff Bosser talks to a couple of experts on character acting. Henson Keyes, chair of the acting program at the University of Illinois, and character actor Stephen Tobolowsky, seen in movies ranging from Groundhog Day to Basic Instinct. Our program begins after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Today we're going to explore the art of acting from the perspective of someone other than the leading man. We'll be listening back to a conversation Jeff Bossert had in 2011 with Stephen Tobolowsky and Henson Keyes. Henson chairs the acting program at the University of Illinois. He's been involved in more than 120 productions as either an actor or a director. Stephen Tobolowsky is a prolific character actor. His roles include that of Bill Murray's old high school acquaintance Ned Ryerson in the movie Groundhog Day, and former Glee Club director Sandy Ryerson in the TV show Glee. To start the program, here's a montage of clips from a few of Stephen Tobolowsky's most recognized characters.
Phil Connors, I thought that was you.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for watching.
Hey. Now, don't you tell me you don't remember me, because I sure as heck fire remember you.
Not a chance.
Ned! Ryerson! Needle Nose Ned the Head, come on, buddy, Case Western High! Ned Ryerson, I did the whistling belly button trick at the high school talent show. Bing! Ned Ryerson got the shingles real bad senior year, almost didn't graduate. Bing! Again! Ned Ryerson, I dated your sister Mary Pat a couple times till you told me not to anymore. Well?
Ned Ryerson?
Bing!
Bing! So did you turn pro with that belly button thing, Ned, or...
No,
what?
Phil, I sell insurance.
What a shock.
Do you have life insurance? Because if you do, you could always use a little more. Am I right? Right.
Ah, what a pity. What a pity. So, Princess, you thought you could outwit the imperious force of... You idiots! These are not them. You've captured their stunt doubles! Search the area! Find them!
It seemed to many of us in Yankton that in the aftermath of Magistrate Claggett's disappearance, you chose different companions.
Last I saw Claggett, he rode in here with General Crook. I figured he left with him too.
And perhaps was plucked up, subsequently from amidst the troops by savages. Yes, such moonlight treachery being their stealthy hallmark.
I've got two words for you. Josh Groban. He's coming to the PTA event.
Who is Josh Groban?
Who is Josh Groban? Kill yourself! He is an angel sent from heaven to deliver platinum records unto us. And if he were here right now, I would club you to death with his Critics' Choice Award.
All right, there you go. Four clips from Stephen Tobolowsky. That was with Bill Murray, and probably Stephen's most known role as his insurance salesman Ned Ryerson in Groundhog Day, as a guard captain in the Mel Brooks film Spaceballs, taking a dramatic turn as Hugo Jari in the HBO series Deadwood, and that last clip, Sandy Ryerson, a recurring character on Glee.
Yeah, it was pretty remarkable that you were able to find a clip from Deadwood that didn't feature any profanity.
Oh, I know. Well, there was a nasty word right before that line of dialogue. I haven't actually watched Deadwood, but I did. I was able to get a hold of season two, and I'm like, oh, there he is. So talk about when you realize you're going to have to make it as a character actor. I mean, you don't have the looks of a leading man. When did you start losing your hair and realizing that... you're going to have to, you know, pick a lot of backup roles.
Well, I think, yeah, I get that question a lot of when I became a leading man, and I think that actually happened at the Champaign-Urbana when I was at the Kranert Center for graduate school. I was doing a Tom Stoppard's Jumpers, and I was playing an 86-year-old man who talked nonstop with physics principles that no one in the audience or myself or our director could understand. And the audience had this kind of vacant look in their eye, like, are we there yet, during that play? And we never were. However, to play the 86-year-old man, at first our director wanted to put me in a wig in which I looked like a very tall Granny Clampett. And I said, you know, this isn't going to work because the audience is going to laugh at me every time they see me, you know, and they'll expect me to be serving possum pie. And finally, they came up with the solution to spray my hair with streaks and tips, which they did for 2 weeks straight of the gray streaks and tips. So I just looked like a bad high school actor instead of Granny Clampett. And the result of that, I am sure, is that after 2 weeks of that performance, I was in the shower after our last matinee, and huge, huge handfuls of hair came out of my head. And, I mean, clumps. It was like in the science fiction movies or something, like I was near a nuclear reactor. And the result was, from that moment on, I was a character actor by choice of nature and not by choice of desire. And that was that. And then it was the long road of understanding what it takes to really be a character actor in Hollywood, which is different than what you learn acting is, in a way, as you study it in school.
And what year were you here at the U of I?
Boy, I'm thinking it was 75, 76, because I came out to Los Angeles the summer of 76. So that was right after U of I. So I guess it was the fall of 75, spring of 76.
So streaks and tips changed your career.
Absolutely.
You know,
streaks and tips did it.
Yeah, I have the same experience of losing my hair early and playing old guys most of my career. But for me, it was white shoe polish that I used to use that took away most of mine.
Well, I want to find out from each of you, you know, when you first decided, and again, Stephen, we talked about this a little bit last year, but how early in your life you decided you wanted to be an actor, or was it a seminal moment that made you realize something, a performance you saw that made you believe that you wanted to do this, or, you know, believe that you had the ability to do it?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we start with our in-studio guest, Henson, talked about what inspired you to become an actor.
You know, I don't really remember wanting to be anything else, even when I was a little kid. I think I wanted to be a journalist for a while, but then a fireman and all that, but that didn't last long. And I think it's the first time I still remember the first laugh I ever got on stage when I was a freshman in high school. And it's sort of transformative because you suddenly went, oh, my gosh, I did that. And I've just pretty much stayed at it ever since.
And I know, Stephen, you talked to me about being a musician at first with a very young Stevie Ray Vaughan. And
Let me just, you know, Henson just brought up something in my memory. Let me jump on that a second. I remember, of course, when I was very, the reason I always wanted to be an actor from the very beginning too, just like Henson. And the reason you want to be an actor seemed to change for me. At first, for me, it was proximity to monsters. I thought that the monsters were real. I loved Godzilla, I loved Frankenstein and the Wolfman, and I thought that if I was an actor, or as it were, I don't know, if I was an actor, I would be able to spend time with Frankenstein and Godzilla and hang out with them and have quality time. And as I got older, I realized that was not going to be. Now, as you were mentioning, I had this love of music, because I loved this girl in my second grade class, Claire Richards. And she played the piano so beautifully that I always wanted to be a musician, even though I always wanted to be an actor. But it came to a head when I was at one of my first recitals, and I started playing the piano, and my piece began with a series of arpeggios that went up the keyboard. And then the third one, blah, 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 blah. And for the first time, I played those three so perfectly and so beautifully that I thought I would add a fourth. Just throw it in there. And so I did the fourth, and I ran out of keys and fell off the end of the piano bench. The audience started laughing and was aghast and was horrified. I jumped up from the piano. I pulled the score up and said, "Don't be upset. Don't be alarmed. It's all part of the piece." And I pointed to a thing in the piece saying, "See, it says pianist falls off bench." And the whole audience laughed and applauded. And that's the moment I knew, when I got that laugh, that I wanted to be an actor. I was in the wrong profession. And I left music, sort of.
You were also a member of a rock band, and I thought about using that clip as well, but I had a song that your producer from the Tobolowsky file sent me, but I decided not to work that in this time.
Oh, I see. Yes, in high school, I graduated high school. I was actually a freshman, maybe even a little older at SMU, but there was a group I had in, was a member of in high school called Cast of Thousands, and we were sort of a folk kind of band. And I was a triple threat. I couldn't sing, I couldn't play the guitar, and I could not play bass. And occasionally I was required to do all three. And one of the leaders of our group was Bobby Foreman, who was actually extremely talented, and he went on to be a member of the New Christy Minstrels. Bobby said that through his connections, that we were able to be one of five bands in Dallas to make an album called A New High. And we could go to the studio and record two songs, and he asked this kid to play lead guitar on it, a kid named Stevie Vaughan, who was Stevie Ray Vaughan. And I was really upset that he was jobbing out guitar parts to this 14-year-old kid that none of us really knew. And I said, "Bobby, you know, I could play these guitar parts." And Bobby just kind of rolled his eyes and said, "Steven, this kid Stevie is, like, really good, and he'll make us sound like we know what we're doing. So just cool it on that." So we got to the studio, and there was this kid, Stevie Vaughan, sitting there with a guitar in his lap. And he said, "Why don't you let me hear the song, see what you got." We did about 30 seconds of it, and he said, "That's enough, got it." And we recorded, and that was the first recording ever of Stevie Ray Vaughan on that record. And, of course, the record never sold. We ended up, like, with boxes of records in our garage. So it is there for posterity. The first moment with Stevie Ray.
Can you talk about being a character actor versus a leading man? The pros and cons. You seem to have a lot of versatility. I mean, I associate you most with something like Groundhog Day, something a little silly. But you also got, like, we played that clip from Deadwood, and I found some other movies where you weren't such a nice guy. You were tracking down Mel Gibson and Bird on a Wire, and you had a fight, and then you get eaten by piranhas. And
well, it's, you know, and Henson can speak to this. It's a different world in film and in theater. Mm-hmm. In theater, I still play leads and can play leads, and it's a whole different thing, because the writer of a piece of theater is bringing an entire universe to the audience, whereas a writer of a piece of entertainment, whether it be Deadwood or whatever, is kind of aiming for a certain genre. In film, when you're a character actor, you have to really bring, I guess, what Stanislavski would call that 24-hour life, the entire life of the character, to the script, because the screenwriter not only hasn't thought about it, occasionally, it's not even logical of what you have to do as a character actor, and you have to kind of bend yourself into a pretzel to bring the full life of a character to a movie script. Whereas a playwright generally will think about all the characters that he's written about, and there is a kind of a more complete logic to what's on the page. Have you found that true, Henson? What do you think?
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. And I think it's a great example for student actors now to see your work, because you are maybe the only character actor I can think of who really goes all the way without ever crossing the line into it being too much. And I think that's the major trick that a character, it's not even a trick, it's an important function of the character actor, is to see how far you can go without making it outrageous to the point where the audience doesn't believe it. And I think, Stephen, you're the guy who has really figured out how to do that, and that's, I think, one reason why your career has taken off so well.
Well, thank you. It you know, there is, I'll reference theater books, too, because I know a lot of the listeners could be, you know, some of the students at the U of I and things like this. I know in Boleslavsky's First Six Lessons, mm-hmm. which was a great book.
Yeah.
That I'd say, he talks about something in one of the chapters which has served me well in film and television, regardless of how good or slight the material is. And that is, he says, you always have to consider the world created by the writer.
Mm-hmm.
The tone, play the reality created by the writer. If you are in a piece that is essentially a comedy, a lightweight comedy, a sitcom, and you're playing an alcoholic, unless it is a very special episode of Glee, you know, they don't want the show to be a serious statement about the dangers of alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
That will cross the line. It will break the fabric of what the material can hold.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, if you are doing a piece that's serious, if you're doing some sort of government paranoia drama or CIA or people getting murdered or this around, you've got to be careful about breaking the boundaries of, and making the material too, bringing in something that makes the material too silly.
Mm-hmm.
That is funny, but funny for its own sake, and kind of violates the rules as created by the writer, is kind of what I've found.
I saw on IMDb that you won an award over the weekend at the Big Bear Lake International Film Festival.
It was sort of an award for it was an acting award for acting excellence of what they called, and they assembled a clip, and I would think that they would put together a cornucopia of different things I'd done throughout my career, both serious and comedic. But the fellow who edited the clip together was enamored of all the movies in which I'd been punched. it was like something from, it looked like I was there because I could take a punch. I mean, it went from Groundhog's Day to Bird on a Wire to different things where Garfield, different movies where different people are punching me. Bossa Nova, I'm punched. And it was clip after clip. I mean, I found it hilarious. And they called me up there to accept the award. I mean, I was thrilled. Is it a line in King Lear to be mentioned is to be overpaid? Is that it? I think, is that Kent or one of those guys? And that's what I felt. I felt to be mentioned was to be overpaid. And I'm always grateful for someone tipping their hat to me and giving me a trip to Big Bear or something. Mm-hmm. But it was delightful. It was a very fun festival.
I don't know how much insight you would have on this, but we did have an emailed question to us. Somebody asks, is there any chance the Deadwood TV movies will ever happen?
I don't think so, and again, it is financial. And that's the only reason why Deadwood isn't on the air. Just a brief course in finances on how TV works. Back in the 90s, a television show, a one-hour television show, say take 30-something, if you remember that show, it would be an average shooting time of about 14 days. Then a lot of production went up to Canada, where it was a lot cheaper and you worked a lot quicker. And they actually got shooting time of a show down to like 7 days, which was brutal. Instead of doing 6 pages a day in a script, you were doing 11, 12 pages a day. This was brutal. Deadwood, the final episode of Deadwood in season 2, took 30 days to shoot.
Right.
1 hour. 30 days. I've done films that were shot in 21 days, 24 days, 27 days, 30 days. David Milch, amazing mind, brilliant, brilliant man. And at the same time, he was very determined to get what he wanted. And if a scene did not go the way he wanted it to go, after he filmed it, after it was edited and in the piece, he said, we have to rewrite it, reshoot it, bring in 200 head of cattle, bring me 300 extras. We're going to do a new scene of have a cattle stampede going down the street and do this other scene. And the people at HBO just said, we can't do this anymore. And for a while, they kept the sets at the where we shot it, which was at the Melody Ranch, Gene Autry's Melody Ranch in Castaic, out here in the boondocks in Los Angeles. And those sets were there waiting for the Deadwood movie to happen. And so far it hasn't happened, and now Tim and Powers and Ian and everybody has gone off on their other movie careers. Now I think it's going to be impossible to get the cast together again. So I don't think it's going to happen.
Well, thanks to the fan who wrote in about that. Let's talk about roles on stage, because we've reflected a lot on some of the parts you've played and productions you've directed. Is there a key one or two roles there that you're like, boy, I love doing this, and I would love the chance to have play this leading role again?
Well, no question for me, it's King Lear. That I've done six productions of Lear, but only once played the title role, and there's just an infinite. I mean, you could play that 50 times and still be finding something different every time. I always really wanted to play Hamlet, but we've gotten to the point now where I would have to find an 80-year-old Claudius and Gertrude in order to make it work, so I don't think that's going to happen. But yeah, certainly Lear, and that's number one for me.
Henson, did you ever play Gloucester?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
Which I loved, too. Gloucester is a great... Did you?
No, sir. Ah. No, sir. I have only watched several productions of Lear, have not been a single one of them, but I always thought that Gloucester is the role that could really kill an audience.
Yeah. Especially when he gets his eyes gouged out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there, Stephen, a key role for you on stage? I mean, you talked about you've still had a lot of lead roles in that form.
Two of them. I did Homer in Mornings at 7,
mm-hmm.
and that's a spectacular play. And it's a play that works on an audience almost like our town. It's beautiful, it's funny, it's heartbreaking, and every role in there is beautifully crafted. In terms of classical theater, quite by accident, I was directing a production of Heartbreak House.
Mm.
I had gone through three shotovers because they shotover is an old man. He's in his 80s, and it was probably the role Shaw saw himself as playing, and I lost three of them, and we were opening in a week, and I had to step in with beard and wig,
wow,
and streaks and tips as shotover. And I have to tell you, I was only in my mid-50s when I did it, but that is an incredible part, a beautiful, beautiful play, amazing part, amazing role. And when I get a little older, when I get the right age to do it, I would love to do shotover as long as my brain is still intact.
Me too. I've never done that one.
Oh,
great.
It's the most difficult Act 3
mm-hmm.
I have ever done. If people don't know the play, it is a group of people kind of having a party, I think as one of my teachers used to say, a tea party at the brink of doom,
mm-hmm.
right at the beginning of the war. And Act 3 is everyone out on the veranda. It's nighttime, and bombs start falling in the distance and coming closer. And you have this group of six characters, and none of the dialogue connects with anything else. They're each in their own kind of reveries, and then the bombs start falling, and it's very difficult to keep the fabric of Act 3 together, and it's magic when it works. Mm-hmm. When it works, it's horrifying. Mm-hmm. And Beautiful play, beautiful play.
You mentioned Our Town there for a second. I'm directing that in the spring here. You want to come out and play the stage manager?
Oh, God. If I'm free.
All right.
You know, it is one of the great plays.
Oh, yeah.
Ever. You cannot kill that play. It is so spectacular. It works. I mean, I played the stage manager when I was in high school, and I remember I was depressed when my drama teacher said, "Stephen, I'd like you to be the stage manager in Our Town," because I thought she wanted me backstage.
Yeah.
I did that play. I directed it, and it was a great, great production. And Carl Malden came to see it, and he was in the original production of Our Town. And I think he played the paper boy. And he was telling me stories of the first production of Our Town, which are incredible. And I'll just tell one short one, is that Thornton Wilder always wanted that play to be done in New York. And he got the opportunity, a man owned a theater, and says he got 3 weeks. So they loaded the play in. They had 3 days to kind of get it up on its feet. And Carl Malden was saying no one left the theater. It was 3 days. People were spending the nights in the theater. They brought in deli sandwiches to eat. And while they were rehearsing, Thornton Wilder said, "You know, there's something missing in this play. It's the moment where George and Emily fall in love." And he pulled out a pad of paper and hand wrote the soda fountain scene, handed it out to the actors one time through, no rewrites. It went in the script, and it's arguably one of the most famous scenes in the play.
Yep.
I'm Jim Meadows, and you're listening to an encore broadcast of Focus. This hour, we're listening back to Jeff Bossert's conversation with Stephen Tobolowsky and Henson Keyes. You may recognize Stephen from his role as Sandy Ryerson in the TV show Glee. Henson is the chair of the acting program at the University of Illinois. We're going to take a short break. This is Focus on WYLL AM 580. Welcome back to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and you're listening to an encore program from 2011. Jeff Bossert is talking with character actor and director Stephen Tobolowsky. He's well known for his characters Ned Ryerson in Groundhog Day and Sandy Ryerson on the TV show Glee. Also in the conversation, Henson Keyes, chair of the University of Illinois acting program.
Henson, is there a dream role you still like to take on? Is there something you're like, I still would like the opportunity to tackle this if the opportunity allows?
Well, still hard to say. I mean, there's a lot of dream roles I have. And I would actually say Prospero in The Tempest is the one Shakespearean role that I haven't done that I feel like I'm ready to do now.
Stephen, anybody you either other roles you would like to have or people you'd like to work with? I really want
to. I'd like to work with Henson.
Yeah.
I'd like, you know, it's one of the things that I found unfortunate. I mean, it's a sad thing. Is that I studied a lot of Shakespeare in college and in school, and I have never, you know, out here professionally, nobody does Shakespeare.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just not done out here. You really have to go to the festivals, you know, Ashland, and you have to get into some of the theaters where they do it. I just did out here at the Mark Taper Forum, they had a director come out from the Royal Shakespeare, and we were going to do a production of Hamlet, a reading, and they asked me to do a Polonius in that, which was a ton of fun. However, I mean, it's no secret, Henson. I mean, what you're dealing with usually with Hamlet is a cutting of the play.
Yeah.
They cut the play, and because who wants to sit through a 4.5-hour play? Well, the problem is, throughout history, what people end up judging when they look at Hamlet is the cutting, as opposed to what the play really is. And I think people have found that when you have the entire play, it actually feels shorter than when you have a bad cutting.
We've got a caller on the line in Savoy. Go ahead.
Question for Stephen. Did you ever do an episode in Seinfeld?
Yes, I did. I played Tor Eklund, the faith healer.
Yes, I thought so.
Yeah.
I recognized your inflection.
Uh-huh.
Terrific.
That was kind of an interesting story. I was working on a movie at that time called Calendar Girl, in which I played a mobster who had a brother who was a deaf mute. And so for that play, for that movie, they were going to have to teach me sign language for the deaf. So I was going to classes for sign language, deaf sign language, at Columbia Pictures. And that's when Mark Hirschfeld for Seinfeld called up. He was then the casting director of Seinfeld. And he said, we were having problem with the role. Can you come in and meet with me and Jerry and see if you can make it funny? So I said, sure. So I went in, and they explained the part of the faith healer, and I said, well, what if I did sign language to every, but made-up sign language? Part of it was part of my sign language for the deaf, but part of it was just made-up signs I did in the moment. What if I just did signs throughout the entire thing? And I did it with Jerry, and we kind of did through it, and he said, well, yeah, that's funny. You could do that. So that's kind of how Tor Eklund happened, was a conspiracy of good luck.
Well, that was a classic episode. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Stephen, is there anyone out there that you found to be a teacher that you really didn't expect to, I don't know whether it be another actor or director or someone that really became, I don't want to say a mentor, but someone that you really picked up a lot of things from and had not anticipated such a connection with them?
You know, to be perfectly honest with you, is I find it, and I don't mean this to be a non-answer answer, but I find it all the time. And I think that may be one of the keys to longevity in this business. One of my teachers, a great teacher, Bernard Hopgood, who was also at the University of Illinois, gave me a bit of advice. And he said, Stephen, you will find that by the age of 20, and Henson, you tell me if you see this too, at the age of 27, a lot of people shut down learning. They quit learning, and they kind of say, I know what I know when it comes to acting, and that's the end of it. Hob told me at the U of I, he said, whatever you do, keep finding something to learn as you progress in your career. So, yeah, from the University of Illinois, there was a teacher I had, Ed K. Martin, who at one point was a great villain in my life. And as our relationship grew over the next several years in and out of school, I realized he was one of the great acting teachers I ever had. And I met him at the U of I. On a lot of the shows I'm on, I learned great acting advice from directors and cameramen. For example, I've learned from cameramen that when you are doing this, I guess the new avant style is the handheld camera, and the jerky camera motion with the multiple cuts. We see it all the time now, Law and Order kind of swinging camera back and forth. The more the camera moves, the more hyper-realistic your performance has to be. Now, that I learned from a cameraman. So there are unexpected sources of knowledge that come to you from all sorts of quarters. You just have to be able to listen to it.
You're imparting a lot of this on, we haven't mentioned yet, the Tobolowsky Files. How did this this portion of the Slash Film website get started and these stories you've been telling us the last couple of years?
Well, I guess about 20 years ago, 20 years ago, I was in my kitchen telling some of the stories from my life, true stories from my life, and a director, cinematographer friend of mine, Robert Brinkman, said, you know, we ought to set a camera up and just do a movie of you telling stories. And I thought, yeah, that's a great idea. And my inner dialogue was saying, that sounds like watching grass growing. That's great. So we both said it was a great idea. We did nothing about it until 2005, and we were both free. And also an invention of HD, high-definition film, came up where the two of us could actually do a film of me telling my stories and have it not cost $1 million, because HD is so inexpensive. So we did a movie called Stephen Tobolowsky's Birthday Party. The editing disc, the disc on which we edited it, we borrowed all the equipment. We did this movie with no rehearsal, no permits, no nothing. We just shot it for 4 days. As we edited it, one of the discs ended up left in the equipment we had borrowed. And when we returned it, it went back to one of Robert's friends at HBO, and they saw the movie. And they called Robert up and said, "We just saw your movie. It's fantastic. How would you like to premiere it at the HBO Comedy Festival in Aspen?" And we go like, "Well, sure." So it ended up, from 2005 until even now, it's playing all over the world in film festivals. About 3 years ago, David Chen at SlashFilm.com saw this movie and loved it and wanted to interview me about the movie. At that time, I had broken my neck, and I was in a cast and was not doing much of anything. And in one of the breaks, David said, "How would you like to do a part two of Stephen Tobolowsky's Birthday Party, where you tell true stories from your life and from your career as a podcast, and I'll produce it?" So I wasn't doing anything, so we started it. And that was about 50, 51 episodes ago. And since then, we've done 51 episodes of The Tobolowsky Files, which is on iTunes now and at SlashFilm at TobolowskyFiles.com. It's totally free, totally free. No salesman will call. But in the meantime, we got public radio in Seattle, wrote us and asked, could we play it? The Tobolowsky Files, and they picked up the Tobolowsky Files, as did Louisville. Now we've heard Austin, Texas has played some of the Tobolowsky Files. Las Vegas is just, and all public radio stations, where now it's starting to get out into public radio, which I'm thrilled about, and I'm starting to do the stories live. So that's kind of how the Tobolowsky Files happened. It started in a kitchen and is going to end up on a stage somewhere.
Wow, I think that might be another reason for you to try to recruit Stephen to the, back to the U of I, so maybe you could answer if you want to.
That's
you...
right. Do the stage manager and do,
there you go.
Do a Tobolowsky File story.
Excellent. I'm interested in knowing, my students will all ask me, get mad at me if I don't ask you, what were the first steps that you took in your career? Did you go straight from to Los Angeles as your base in the beginning?
I did. And the reason I did was because it was easier to be poor in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
It was cheaper and the weather was better. That's the only reason I went to Los Angeles. And when you're in Los Angeles, I had a kind of mantra, find an agent, find a job, find a good agent, find a good job.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a series of agents that couldn't get me in anywhere. I ended up doing children's theater, but it was equity. It was equity, mm-hmm. So we did get paid. And we traveled all over California, and again, I learned a lot of unexpected things by doing children. And we had a lot of great people in our company. We had Mayor Winningham mm-hmm. was in our company. Brian Stokes Mitchell was wow. in our company, all at the beginning of their career, before they branched off and Brian becoming a huge Broadway star and Mayor just nominated for an Emmy Award.
Yeah.
And after that, boy, I got very, okay, I'm following the line of the trail of chronic depression. I got very depressed because it was very hard to do anything, and I got a job doing regional theater. And I felt like I was as far away from my dream as I could possibly be. I was performing in Buffalo, New York, doing Whose Life Is It Anyway? And the Miss Firecracker Contest. They wanted me to play Lenny in Of Mice and Men. And while I was doing Miss Firecracker Contest, one of the other actors in the show had an agent from New York. And she invited him to the show. Mm-hmm. After the performance, he called me up and said, "Do you have an agent?" I said, "No, sir." He said, "You do now." He Great. Called me to come to Manhattan on my day off, so I came in from Buffalo, And I had 17 interviews set up for my days off from this one agent. Mm. He then called his associates in California and said, you have a new client, Stephen Tobolowsky. And I immediately jumped from Jeff Hunter, who was one of the leading agents in New York, from having no agent to a leading agent, to having a leading agency in Los Angeles from having no agent. And that made a huge difference. But it all came from not doing anything different, but from persevering, from doing children's theater when I could do nothing, to doing student films when I could do nothing, to doing regional theater, which is fulfilling in its own way. But again, you feel very isolated from being in New York or Los Angeles, performing in Buffalo or St. Louis, but you are in a world of your own, and you feel creative and alive, and you keep that little flame alive. And I was lucky in that someone saw me. Ironically, I was nominated for a Tony Award for Mornings at 7. And at the Tony Award party, Jeff Hunter was there. Mm. And I had not seen Jeff since the early 80s, since he was signed me as his client. And I went up to him and I said, Jeff, I have to thank you so much for changing my life, for helping me. Your vote of confidence is why I'm here today. And Jeff said, I have no idea what you're talking about. I have no idea who you are. What are you doing? I said, well, you saw me in Miss Firecracker in Buffalo. He said, total blank. Wow. Don't recall it at all. So it was a cipher in his mind, but for me it was life-changing. And that's it, is keeping, for the young actors out there, it's keeping it burning, keeping it going, and persevering, and not assuming that what you're doing is the wrong path just because it's not the path you imagined.
Exactly, exactly. Did were you in the production in Mornings at 7 that Dan Sullivan directed?
Yes.
Yeah, you know, he is currently teaching my class at this very moment.
That's fun.
Yeah.
Well, what a bunch of lucky students.
I know, totally.
Dan is so fabulous. That production was fabulous, and then we were lucky enough to do it out here in Los Angeles, too.
Mm-hmm.
Great cast. It was just a wonderful experience.
We're very lucky to have Dan here six weeks or so every semester.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
You mentioned doing Miss Firecracker contest. Well, your girlfriend in the days at U of I was Beth Henley.
That is correct.
The author of that play, and I did not give her the appropriate props last time we spoke. And
it was at the University of Illinois, in fact. There was one playwriting student, Claudia Riley. And Claudia Riley asked Beth and I, we were both actors at the U of I, if we would do a reading of her play, which we did, which was a wonderful play. Claudia is a wonderful writer. But it was on that walk home after that play, Beth said, that was very brave what Claudia did. And I was saying, I don't really, what are you talking about? And she said, well, she wrote this play. She's a woman, and she wrote this play. And I said, well, she took a class in playwriting. I mean, you know, women can be, you know, riding the rodeo now. It's, you know, it's, times have changed. And Beth said, you know, I think I want to be a writer. And I said, well, that's good, honey. You do that. You be a writer. Again, I had no idea that I was sitting on a keg of nitroglycerin. And Beth started writing scraps of paper, bits of notes. She wrote a screenplay while we were at the U of I, and her experience working with John Ahart, who was a professor at the U of I, doing his Lincoln Show in Springfield. That was the first year that Lincoln Show was in existence. And then afterwards, Beth came out to Los Angeles to join me, and she worked on this play, typing on her little typewriter. And at the end, she was handing me pages, and it was called Old Granddaddy's Dying. And the title of the play lacked a little curb appeal. But as I'm reading it and thinking, this could be the best play I've ever read. And I'm reading it, and it is the play that became Crimes of the Heart.
Mm.
And at the end, I was crying, and I said, Beth, this is beautiful. And she said, do you think we'll be able to do it at one of our equity waiver theaters in California here? And I said, honey, I said, this is going to be on Broadway. I said, this is as good as it gets. And sure enough, I think it was a year, 2 years later, Beth won the Louisville, the Great American Play Contest, mm-hmm. with a couple failed productions to go to New York in between. And then she got an off-Broadway production, then won the Pulitzer Prize. The play moved to Broadway, nominated for a Tony Award, made into a movie, nominated for an Academy Award. And that all came from a night watching Claudia Riley at the University of Illinois. And, of course, to me, the killer part of the story is that, still kills me, opening night of Crimes of the Heart on Broadway, Claudia Riley drove across the country to see the opening night of the play. Claudia had no idea of the influence she had had on Beth's life. And at intermission, everybody thought Claudia Riley, who looked like a playwright, was Beth Henley. And everybody gathered around Claudia, pushing Beth away, saying, excuse us, honey, we know the Henleys from Mississippi. You know, we want to talk to Attell Bob about a play. And Claudia listened to everyone and said, you know, I'm just going to let you keep talking because I cannot wait to see the expression on your face when I tell you what you just did. The play was a huge success, and as part of the contract of the play, Beth had the rights to do what they called the novelization of the play, which is a book form of the movie that kind of they sell in grocery stores. And Beth was busy writing another play, and she asked her agent if she could give that job to someone else. And her agent said, yeah, as long as someone could write. And so Beth gave the job of writing the novelization of Crimes of the Heart to Claudia Riley.
Oh.
And so Beth was responsible for giving Claudia Riley her first writing job. And Claudia was responsible for inspiring Beth to write in the first place.
That's a terrific story. I think if anybody's been listening, figured out why the Tobolowsky Files has become so popular. Just a couple of minutes left. Henson, if you had anything else you wanted to ask, Stephen.
I always ask to take back to my students, is there a big do and a big don't do that you would recommend for a kid who's starting out today as opposed to back when we were heading out there?
Mm-hmm. The for me, and Henson, I don't know if you have the same ideas or not. I just throw it out there.
Mm-hmm.
To me, I think the biggest mistake I see people make in acting is they think it's all about emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about clarity of thought.
Exactly.
If you can read the material and understand who your person is, you will always be emotionally appropriate, especially men. Men always think they, quote, have to be emotional to be actors, and consequently they either scream or yell or they play through anger or fake tears. They do all sorts of terrible things. But if you can think clearly, we are all human beings. We all are emotional 24/7. Then you will be emotionally appropriate for whatever you're doing in the scene. And the big do is be a good listener.
Mm-hmm.
Always be a good listener. All life comes from the eyes of the other person on stage. Be a good listener.
Bravo.
I'm Jim Meadows, and you've been listening to an encore broadcast of Focus, Jeff Bossert's conversation with character actor Stephen Tobolowsky and University of Illinois acting chair Henson Keyes, first aired in 2011. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. Tomorrow on Focus, a program devoted to one of the most powerful lawmakers to come out of East Central Illinois. Joseph Cannon of Danville was Republican Speaker of the House in the early 20th century, representing his party's old guard, trying to hold back the progressive movement. We'll learn about Cannon's political career on Thursday's show. This is Focus on WYLL AM 580.